Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Oni Patton Power as a guest. Hi, Oni.
Hello.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you for being with us today, coming all the way from South Africa to meet us in person.
Yes, exactly.
Just for the podcast.
Yes.
So it's very special to have you here today, especially with all the traveling. It's a beautiful rainy day in London, even more special. So as a way of introduction, I'll just say a little bit about you. Oni is the founder of Intelligent Impact. She is also an entrepreneur in residence at the Skoll Centre for Entrepreneurship, an associate fellow at the University of Oxford Said Business School, a visiting fellow at the London School of Economics, Marshall Institute, and advisor to the Bertha Centre for Social Innovation at the University of Cape Town's Graduate School of Business. That's the short introduction.
I know, it's a handful. It always is. A mouthful, I guess, is better.
And then if I may add, kind of just so that people understand the wide range of things that you do, I understand that you spend your time broadly across three areas. One, which is consulting to a range of organizations, which vary from financial intermediaries, funds, development institutions, all of that on innovative finance and social investment strategies and exponential technologies for impact financing strategies. You also do some advising on innovative finance projects, including developing of South African Impact Investing National Advisory Board, a green investment bank, social impact bonds, development impact bonds, which we cover on one of the podcasts recently, and green outcome funds as well. And you are doing research and lecturing in innovative finance and social finance impact investment technology for impact. Oni has experience in both the mainstream and the impact-oriented finance sectors in North America, Europe, Africa, and Asia. And she holds a BA in International Political Economy from DePauw University and an MBA from the University of Oxford Said Business School. So, wow.
That's a lot.
You thought that the beginning was a lot. So, what an impressive background. Anything I missed?
No, thank goodness. I think that's everything.
Sounds like a lot.
There is one thing it's brand new. We just started an angel investment fund in South Africa for female. It's a female investment fund into female founders. So that's brand new. That's another kind of piece of it, which is going to be really fun, I think.
Wow, amazing. And actually, if you go and see and connect with Oni in the future, you'll see that she's about 25, or she looks 25.
I do, yeah. Yes. Although I do, like, I had two experiences recently where I was called Tani, which is Afrikaans for aunt instead of sister, which was a little bit concerning to me. And then in the airport on the way here, someone called me Mama instead of Sissy, which means I look old. So I'm starting to feel older than 25.
Okay, no, I think they were wrong on that. So the first question I have for you, which is the one that we ask all our guests, is what is impact investing?
It's a great question to start with. So impact investing, the definition that I use, are investments that are made into projects and companies that look for financial as well as social and environmental return. I'm now a big fan of the new IFC operating principles for impact investing, which go a bit further beyond the intentionality and actually talking about measurement and reporting and transparency.
Anything in particular around the IFC that you really like?
So it's a new set of operating principles that have been released a few weeks ago. They have, I think, 61 signatories. And it goes kind of beyond it was in partnership with the GIN, and it goes beyond the GIN's pure kind of intentionality, which I also agree with. And actually looks at 7 or 8 different pieces, principles mm-hmm. for impact investments. And I think it's starting to develop into more of a framework for what is the difference between traditional investment and impact investing. And I think a lot of us in the industry hope that it emerges. So, you know, all investments can and should be impact investments. Some have positive and negative. But, you know, impact investors as a tribe, as a set of individuals and companies are focused on measuring impact and optimizing their investments towards positive social impact as defined mostly by the SDGs.
Okay. I actually have a question that we're going to pick this up again a bit later, but I want to just again just share a bit more background with people, talk a little bit about Intelligent Impact. So that is your main company, although you have all these different activities, but that's your conduit to operate, right? So if I read a little bit about it on actually from your website, it says that Intelligent Impact was founded to explore how to harness artificial intelligence, machine learning to help solve one of the intractable problems in the social impact finance fields, which is how to access information that is reliable and actionable. By the way, the website is intelimpact.com. Can you tell us a little bit more about what it is that you are doing and or trying to do?
Sure. So I've been in impact investing for about 8 years now, a little bit over. And I would say about 2 years ago, I started to get pretty frustrated that some of the intractable problems, the wicked problems in impact investing, we didn't seem to be making enough progress. And so for me, I kind of said, well, what can I do about that? A lot of my career has really been trying to figure out the biggest blockages, you know, the impact investing space, and trying to work towards, you know, my own contribution to fixing them. And so I decided to spend, I didn't know how much time, but a significant amount of time trying to understand the opportunities in AI, machine learning. I ended up also being remote sensing and things like drones, IoT. So all these different technologies that I believed I didn't know, and I found it very difficult to find any really good information at the beginning on how these technologies could be applied to impact investing, not just to companies. And companies, there's, I've got tons of great examples of companies that are using these technologies for impact, but more, how do we use them to do things that are difficult in impact investing, around particularly around capital allocation? And so that's what I've been doing. And I've spent a couple of years now and working with companies, working with investors, understanding these technologies, building a prototype that failed. I'm working on different kind of platforms. So now I've gotten to the point where I feel like I have a good grasp on what is possible. And so I'm trying to help organizations, governments, development finance institutions, funders, high net worths, be able to optimize their strategies to use these types of technologies. And I, as I say in every technology conference I speak at, I'm not a technologist. I can't build the stack, but I have a good enough understanding of what's possible to help people think around things about measurement of impact, allocating of capital, structuring of funds, and potentially the partnership between different types of funders.
Okay. Can you tell us a little bit more about the prototype? So that again, so that people can maybe picture it a little bit.
Yeah. So I tried to build, so I put together the largest set of impact reports and things. So I had had about 40,000 pages of impact investing reports, essentially impact investing reports from all over. Yeah. I still do. I'm pretty sure I have probably the largest library in the world and sitting on my computer. But, and then I tried to use that to essentially do unsupervised learning into an algorithm to be able to help direct individuals to the type of information they needed. The idea was to be able to ask this collective set of body of work, you know, what is best practice in this? So what is best practice in early stage investing in East Africa around exits? What's the definition of impact investing? That's one that's not necessarily that useful, but a variety of different questions. So we built the prototype. We created an interesting map of how these different documents were related. And unfortunately, there was no convergence. Even we tried to train the model, the algorithms, and we realized the amount of training that was going to be needed to have some sort of agreement on any of these questions was going to be, you know, vast. And there's still so much disagreement around some of the very simple tenets of impact investing. And then, to be fair,
and we see that just with the question asked, the first question we asked to everyone, everyone has a different answer. Okay, so that's a good example.
So it didn't work. Totally failed.
Okay.
But I've learned a lot from it, and am now using a lot of that learnings from building that prototype in a couple of other projects, a few other projects actually right now.
Excellent. So if I understand it correctly, then so all the lessons make you realize that you have to go back to this almost individual bespoke approach for each client, or?
Right now, I think what I learned actually, the biggest takeaway for me was that the data isn't good. So I think the biggest takeaway was I thought that we had decent data to start to be able to train algorithms. And what I realized is that we don't. Well, we didn't, at least at that time. I still think we don't quite. We in specific areas are. But what I realized is that I needed to switch my focus, not just to how we build algorithms to be able to train computers and essentially get to hopefully machine learning on things that are important to impact investing. We actually have to go step back and look at how do we use things like the Internet of Things and blockchain and other types of technologies to actually collect the information in a way that can then be used to train the algorithms. So I almost got one step too far ahead of myself.
Okay, which is just to my relevance. So when I talk to impact investors in specifics, you know, the challenge they have is around measurement because there is no data, there is no cohesive data, there is no one framework, which again, that's one of the parts that we're going to talk about. Okay, I understand. So today then, in terms of your clients, who are you talking to, who are you serving through Intelligent Impact?
A wide variety, I think, because I've been in this space for a long time. I can be pretty picky. So I pick the stuff that's quite interesting. Most of the time I actually pass people off. A lot of what I do is actually helping direct people to others that can help them. So I work with high net worths, family offices, development finance institutions, governments, foundations. I've done a lot of work with foundations and essentially, and you know, funders. I do less work with the actual SMEs and startups. I do kind of a series of calls and I try and help them a little bit informally around fundraising, but I just don't have the capacity. So I really try and work with funders as much as possible to help them understand, use both on the technology side, but also on the innovative financing side, which are often interlinked. So a lot of my work actually recently is around alternative early stage financing mechanisms, which I've done quite a bit on from a practical as well as kind of from a research perspective. And I'm in the midst, which we might talk about, with a large open finance institution of potentially putting together a fund to test out some of these mechanisms in a real way.
Okay. I love trying to picture things. So that in a real way means what would it look like?
So we have a lot of examples. So what it is the area that I'm very interested in is this idea of, for lack of a better term, mezzanine financing for SMEs. So I believe relatively strongly, and I've been saying this a little bit more forcefully recently to the chagrin of some of the funds that I actually work with, that the pure private equity model doesn't necessarily work, particularly in Africa and impact. I think there's a role for it, but in general, the model, the VC and PE model, is not producing the type of allocations, capital allocations that we need to actually, you know, really push these startups towards sustainable futures. And part of it has to do with this need for exponential growth, which I think is something that we need to revisit. I've seen firsthand with quite a few friends now that are around Series B, D, C, that are raising, you know, tens, 20, 30s, 50 millions of dollars, and having them actually reflect and say, you know, this perpetual growth at all costs model can be at odds with what we're trying to do as impact startups. And so, you know, for so long we pushed to, oh, well, once we get these startups to scale, you know, once they're starting to be able to raise commercial capital, then, you know, we'll have hit the big shot. And I think that there's a lot of, and particularly I work the most in Africa. So there's a lot of startups that want to run sustainable businesses that might not have exponential growth curves. And we need to fund those as well. Those are huge job creators and they can be really great sustainable businesses. And so there's this real lack of capital at the mezzanine level. There's some funders that are doing it really well. And so for me, it's about, there's examples around doing types of capital, and we can go into them more if you'd like, that look at something between debt and equity and don't necessarily require an exit, a big exit at the end, that have liquidity events throughout. And this allows potentially for funders to build portfolios that are a bit more liquid and also that have a different risk return calculation. And for the entrepreneurs, it potentially allows them to access capital that doesn't require them to grow and to sell and to potentially, you know, change fundamentally. So for me, that's a specific area that I work in, and technology can be really useful in that as well. But that's another area that I'm quite passionate about.
Interesting. Yes, because I'm just thinking about, we mentioned bonds before. Again, you have to be quite developed to be able to access those as well. Mm-hmm. So at the beginning of this journey of the companies, you need to find some way which, again, angels alone cannot provide.
So. Absolutely. It's that space in between. There's actually a great report out that came out last year by the Dutch Good Growth Fund on this mezzanine SME financing space. And they're doing a training actually in Amsterdam at the end of the month on this idea of SME mezzanine financing. And I think the stuff I'm doing is a little bit broader than that, but it's a great kind of starting point and really saying that a lot of angels are also looking to kind of hand off to VCs then to grow kind of exponentially. But you have this space that's kind of between startup and growth, as we call it, where there's working capital needs, there's needs that are not necessarily, you know, just funding them with pure equity. And there's a lot of times that the funders themselves aren't necessarily, and we've seen this a lot in Africa, aren't necessarily interested in selling a piece of the business. They actually just want to access capital. The problem is that straight debt doesn't work either. And so having these ideas of doing this blending where it either can be top line, so it can be based off of revenue, it can be bottom line, it can be based off of dividends, it can be based off of royalties, it can look at multiples of different types of essentially milestones. And so what's been fun for me is working with funders on a kind of slightly more ad hoc basis, like smaller consulting pieces, helping them to develop some of these. And so what I'm hoping to do kind of going forward is to potentially work with a couple of funders with some relatively large funds to develop and test out some of these different and trying to get more to the templating side. Because what I'd love to see is being able to use algorithmic lending to be able to do some templates of these types of mezzanine financing. So you could actually have big pools of capital and where SMEs could come in, apply using technology to be able to understand and using eventually AI and ML to be able to understand the credit risk and be able to help them pick the different types of capital that they need. And I think that's when you're going to start to get some more market clearing, which we're not even anywhere close to now.
Fascinating. Yeah. Now I can see it's like a double-sided platform again, where you have, okay, the automated almost advice to the company,
yep,
which then satisfies the inverted commas lender or funder. Okay.
And you can use things like chatbots as well, right? And this is what's been fun for me the last couple of years is understanding what does it take, for instance, to build a chatbot. Super easy. We could pull the computer up right now and build one in a few minutes. It wouldn't be very good because we haven't trained it on much. But I'm seeing social entrepreneurs build chatbots to do legal advice to undocumented migrants or to women, using them to be able to converse potentially with startups around legal options, around financing options. So it's really about, if possible, making things very bespoke, but in a way that's relatively standardized. And with technology, you're able to do that. It's just that we need to be able to have all the different pieces so you can put them together. And I think our boxes for most funders are quite small now. And a lot of what I've done for the whole 8 years I've been in this space is trying to push those boxes a little bit bigger and have people think a little bit more creatively around how does the capital actually promote the social impact that you're looking for. Just being an impact investor doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to get to that point. The way in which you allocate capital is also very important.
Okay. Can you expand a bit more about that subject?
Sure.
Because capital allocation, it wasn't on my questions, but enlighten us a little bit.
Yeah, sure. So, you can set up structures that can incentivize anything. So impact investors, the idea is to incentivize social enterprises and other types of companies, obviously some nonprofits, et cetera, to be able to create social impact. Now, the problem is if you, for instance, if you're a venture capitalist and the only way that you're measuring the success of the business is on the financial performance, you will likely set up situations with the board, with the CEO, whereby your straight equity investment into them requires a 10 times return in 7 years. So there will be discussions that will be had, even if the core of the operating business is very social, and even if there's protections, and hopefully there are, and we're seeing that more, protections of the social mission actually within the governing documents. There will still potentially be decisions that you have to make. And sometimes some impact investors that are just doing pure equity and VC are great. They push the boards to make those decisions that actually are in the best interest of the end user. And so that's not a problem. But the thing is when you start to potentially broaden the circle and you have investors that are doing impact VC that aren't kind of, I hate the term financial first, but are in that realm of where they see an opportunity, essentially investing into emerging markets, but they aren't necessarily convinced that they're willing to, make longer term decisions for the end user. So financial inclusion is a great one. So, are you willing to continue to push down to get the cheapest cost for a product to enable the most individuals to be able to access this financial inclusion product? And are you pushing to make sure that the products themselves are valuable to the end users? Anyone can sell financial products to the base of the pyramid, right? And they can be terrible. Great example in South Africa is funeral insurance. Funeral insurance in South Africa is a huge scam. It's massive. It's the largest financial product in the entire country. Everyone has it. But most people don't actually collect the benefits. They have multiple ones and they won't pay out. They will stop paying the premium. So essentially, they think they have a savings function for years and years, but they've just been paying premiums. So when they've stopped, they put away money every single month for 10 years. That money's gone nowhere. So that is an example of a product that actually doesn't provide value. So in the long term, you want to provide value because you actually want your customers to continue to come back. But if you are an investor that is just looking for the number of users, the growth per user, the income per user, and that's how you're measuring your success, then you might get to a point where you're selling products that don't necessarily, make sense. So when you're talking about how you allocate capital, when you set up structures that have impact embedded in them, so you can have impact milestones, you can potentially looking at, for instance, you might have a top line revenue, so you might have a percentage of revenue, but there might be something in the contract that says that a certain percentage of your customers have to be in certain socioeconomic perspective, or the value or the rating by customers of a specific piece has to be above a certain perspective. You might be using something like Lean Impact, which is now 60 decibels, to look at the value to your customers. They do text-based surveys to individuals to look at what do your customers think of this. So it's about taking impact measurement and actually embedding that impact measurement into the capital structure.
Okay.
So another good example on a larger piece is recently in the New Forest Fund, which is a forestry fund.
Yeah. Good question. Did you say Lean Impact was the one?
So it used to be called Lean Impact. It actually spun out of Acumen. It's now called 60 Decibels. It's run by Tom Adams. They do incredible work around essentially cell phone-based surveys and templating them and being able to roll them out to customers to be able to actually understand the makeup and the and how customers feel about products. It's an incredible company.
Thank you. Sorry, you were talking about the forest.
So on a different piece, if you're looking at the capital structure,
yeah,
which I do a lot. So the New Forest Fund, which had just had a what was called an impact tranche that the Packard Foundation did within it. So it's a, I think it's a $200 million fund. They do sustainable forestry, which is great. But the Packard Foundation essentially said, we will put $10 million into the fund, but we actually have very specific, we want this to be high impact investing. And actually, we're willing for you to pull in some of the non-commercial pieces into this. So we want you to, you have a $200 million fund, you have everything set up to allocate this capital. We don't want you to start a different fund, but we want to have an impact tranche of this fund. So when there are things that come to the fund that don't necessarily meet the mandate of the other investors, we want you to potentially use our capital to be able to do that. So that allows potentially the fund investors, and for them, they might be able to do things that are potentially smaller projects where the cost benefit isn't the same as their larger piece. And so for them now having this impact tranche, it's a little bit different in that regard in that it's probably going to be potentially separate deals, or they can actually layer that into other deals so that they know that it has specific specifications. They have to have specific impact metrics for that. So how we layer our, how we're looking at and how we're defining capital or how we're allocating capital into individual deals as well as into larger structures can have an impact. We can create incentives for both funders and fundees. One more example, carry. So there's only two funds now in the world that actually tie carry to impact.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to name them, but you can find them on Impact Alpha. They have reported on them in the past 6 months. The first time in 10 years, we've actually had traditional fund managers have their incentives to be tied to impact. That's an incentives piece. And, you know, when I tell people that, and particularly, you know, new students, they're flabbergasted that two out of how many hundreds of funds actually have impact tied to carry. And I know there's discussions on how it can be very difficult, et cetera, but that's another way in which our funds themselves should reflect impact. And then there's things like gender and inclusivity and diversity. So it's not just about allocating capital for impact. It's actually about how we're doing it, how the capital is structured, you know, what types of incentives we have.
Okay, thank you for that. And you mentioned measurement across many of the points, right? So in terms of identifying and measuring kind of impact, I know that there are many, but what is the kind of the key factors that you think are the most important one to start with?
So for me, a lot of my work around measurement has been around moving towards objective measures of impact. And this is where technology can be really useful. So using technology like Internet of Things, IoT, to be able to collect information at source, whether it's sensors or devices that are set up to be able to collect data, things that objectively and instead of subjectively report on events happening. And then where I think there's a lot of possibility, you know, again, talking about what is now 60 decibels, is being able to pair this very objective kind of sensor-based data with more qualitative kind of sensory data. We're asking people, so we have a data point that says that someone entered a clinic because they had a GPS check-in. So we knew that their cell phone was at a specific clinic. They scanned a code or they inputted a code. So we knew they were there. But then what's interesting now is you can follow that up with potentially a survey to say, did this, this, and this happen? Or how did you feel about this visit? How has this affected your life, et cetera? And so by pairing the two of those together, because what we often don't have right now when we're talking about our impact data is we don't have a way to go back to the actual source. We can't verify it. Someone has a spreadsheet. They have, you know, even if it's a spreadsheet, if it's not paper, you can say, oh, we talked to 100 people and here were their thoughts, but we have no way to actually verify that that was 100 people that were spoken to. Mm-hmm. And so, or with farmers, there's amazing stuff that's been done with sensors to be able to look at crop growth, to be able to use things like AI to be able to understand what crops they should be growing, to then lend against those crops, to then be able to measure what is the income multiplication based off of the loans that we're giving to these farmers, based off the amount of food they're growing, and potentially then even using blockchains, the supply chains to understand what they sell to. And then when you sell, like what type of margins are they reaping for this? And so for me, it's very much, I think there's a long way we can go with using technology to be able to capture this objective data and potentially still capture subjective data, but in structured ways that are replicable potentially. And so, and that's why technology has been such a big piece of it. I think there's a human element 100%, but we need better objective data to be able to do optimization.
Mm. this morning I was reading an article in the FT about a rather, I would say, angry and contentious impact investor about 20 years experience saying that how we need to focus more on the human side of it, right? And in one of the interviews, previous interviews, we're talking about social alpha. But the way that you are putting it together is that the way that we get the social alpha and the human side is by using technology in order to get these potentially subjective views that we can translate into an objective calculation.
Yeah, absolutely. So we can use things like, so for instance, if we're doing surveys and in actually reaching out to individuals, we could potentially use technology to do things like sentiment analysis. So if you reach out to 1 million different people that are using specific products across, you know, the entire world, you can, instead of having, you know, 1 million different range, these can be, you know, there don't have to be multiple choice, you know, questions. These can be, how do you feel about a product? We can use AI to do things like sentiment analysis to understand actually in bulk how people are feeling and how a product has potentially influenced their lives. And it's important to be able to have that type of communication with individuals. And I think the human piece is there, but I think the human piece without kind of standardization and potentially without technology is not as efficient and potentially not as effective. And we just don't have, again, for me, it goes back to this ability to optimize. There are going to be good and there are going to be better programs. And sometimes it's okay to have a combination of those, but when we don't know which programs really are having kind of the optimal outcome, then there's opportunity cost.
If I throw you maybe, I don't know if it is a curveball on this one, but you were mentioning before about the new framework.
The IFC's operating principles, right? Yeah.
And I talk to people, and that's one of the things that comes up, is that there are so many frameworks now.
So many
ways to do it. How does it all work then? Because going back to the beginning of this conversation, you were talking about there is no relation sometimes about all the different things that are out there yet.
Not yet.
So, and everyone's trying to, you know, help and do things. Just offline before, I was telling you how we're creating this course. And then you're telling me, actually, there's this course that already exists, you know, for entrepreneurs on impact and includes all these tools. So we tend to do that as humans, right? We recreate the wheel 100 times.
We do.
So what do we do about it? How do we?
So I think something like the
how do we maximize, you know,
yeah,
for efficiency.
Optimize. So I think what's interesting about how the IFC Gen kind of operating principles worked is that they use the Impact Management Project and a couple of other, I mean, I'm not an expert on them. They've come out and I read the report a couple of days ago. So I think it's very new. But what they tried to do was to take some of the, essentially the best thinking out there and pull it into something that was a bit more actionable for investors. And then they had a bunch of signatories, big money signing onto it. And I think that's the way we potentially go forward. So it's not a new framework. And I think the way the Impact Management Project has done it is also right. They set out right away saying, this is not necessarily about creating new ways to measure impact. This is about having a way in which we can all talk about it using the same language. So a friend of mine, Audrey Selane, did a great piece of work for the Bertelsmann Foundation that you can find under its impactfinance.network. Mm-hmm. And they looked at and they discovered 144 platforms for impact finance. And I just 144. And I just did a piece for WEF with a couple of colleagues where we looked at blended finance initiatives. And we actually found 170, which were totally separate from this 144 platforms. So we just have, there's so much. And so what you'll find if you go onto this website is that the ultimate finding was no more platforms. Some of the work that I'm working on, and I think, you know, I hope that others are too, is how do we make things interoperable and actually start to using, again, technology to be able to push information to multiple places and to be able to have things that are overarching. So instead of creating a new framework, and this is what the operating principles are, not necessarily a new framework. They just essentially pull together things that were and push forward a little bit some other pieces. So I think we're going to continue to do it because we're humans, but there's a lot of silos that happen. And so for me, I think I often sit kind of, you know, 20, 40,000 feet. And I do that a little purposely because I want to see everything that's happening and then figure out where the gaps are. And so one of my projects now is really trying to figure out with, you know, using AI, ML, and potentially blockchain is how do we better connect entrepreneurs and investors and projects and investors and projects and funders? And that's not going to be through building a new platform, but potentially through creating technology that allows entrepreneurs to push out their information to a variety of different places. So we don't need new platforms. We don't necessarily need new heuristics. We don't necessarily need new frameworks. We need to test them, apply them, make them interoperable, and, you know, just make them so that they work together. And I think that's where I come down on it.
And since you are here, I may as well mention, so you're doing a workshop in South Africa, in case, you know, listeners are in South Africa, want to come and attend, on impact measurement and management for investors, right? So that's in November.
It's in November, yeah. Okay. So we've got two courses, actually. Well, I've got a lot of courses coming up. Mm-hmm. But the two courses that we run every year at UCT is the impact investing in Africa and then impact measurement and management for investors. And they're both excellent courses. They run over the same week and there's lots of integration and then we do lots of networking. And we have about 130 alumni from the two courses. Impact Measurement only ran for the first time last year and Impact Investing has been running for 5 years now.
Okay.
So they're great courses. You can check them up. If you Google them, Impact Investing in Africa, that will come up. It's a great course. We already have quite a few signups, so I would suggest if people want to come soon.
So brilliant. And then just maybe talking a little bit about the future, and we were talking a lot about AI and why it's important. I think that hopefully listeners kind of got the idea. You are attending a couple of events as well on this, right?
Yeah, so I'm heading over now to a large Delphi finance institution to do a workshop for them on using exponential technologies to structure funds and allocate capital. And then speaking a little bit later in the week at AFSIC about the same thing, which is the African Financial Institution Services. Oh gosh, I don't even know what it stands for.
It's the largest. One of them is in, when the one of the events is in?
Both in London.
In London, okay.
Yeah, both in London.
And then I mentioned to you for the people that are listening as well, and it's interesting. So I'm working, disclaimer there, with the people at COGEX 2019, part of Cognition, and on the impact investment side. But the interesting thing is that they realize as well the how important it is application of AI to impact investment to accelerate the SDGs.
Yeah.
And that's the theme of this year. So
that'd
now, I think that with everything we talked about, people can understand, okay, why it's important and why it makes sense to, you know, bring one together with the other.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that is on the 10th to the 12th of June of 2019. And since I mentioned SDGs, I wanted to ask you, so what are the biggest challenges you think, given everything that we're talking about? Obviously, we have the challenge of the data, the measurement. Anything else you'd like to add?
Lots of things. I think, you know, what's great about the SDGs is they've given us a framework with measurable outcomes that we can, you know, work towards. I think one of the things that's very difficult about them is that they're often very intertwined. So, you know, you do something in water, for instance, and you're not just working on water. You're working with communities, you are working potentially with food sources, you're working with agriculture, you're working with all of these different pieces. And so I think that, you know, we haven't even talked about another piece that I was building was around using kind of blockchain to do some tokenization of the SDGs. And one of the things that we face is there is no market. There's no replicable market like the carbon market for social impact. And I think that what will be potentially interesting is we can get to a point where we take some of these externalities, or as one of my colleagues at Oxford used to say, things we have externalized, because you know, they're not really externalities. Things like inequality and climate change, these things are actually embedded in our costs. And so once we can start to have ways in which funders and individuals and, you know, these are either embedded into costs or separated out and being willing to be paid for, because there's a lot of promise in investing in social enterprises and others that are going to, you know, create change, but also big corporates, nonprofits, governments, infrastructure companies, all these different pieces are part of the puzzle. And so creating actionable opportunities for them is going to be, and doing it fast enough. To be honest, for me, where I sit now, I'm not afraid we're going to get there. I think the momentum is correct. I don't know if we're going to get there fast enough, mm-hmm. particularly with climate change. And so, you know, really mobilizing the capital and really getting big players to do things that are, even if they're not, you know, true impact, but actually on the environmental side, really getting to the point where we're making a difference for climate. That's what I worry about.
Okay. And we talked a lot about capital and allocating and measuring, but I truly believe that unless humans change their behavior, it's very hard to fund companies that nobody wants to use, right?
Yeah.
So any notes on that in terms of how do we get there faster? How do we make people aware faster that they need to change as well in terms of what they're asking? Any idea?
Well, I've seen some cool stuff. So, I mean, like personally, I've cut out, you know, red meat and tried mostly. I think I'm like 95-5 now. I try and say I'm 90-10. You know, that's one thing. And then that creates this huge opportunity for these meatless companies like Impossible and Meat and et cetera and beyond. So I think that's one way. I saw a interesting credit card coming out next week that sets a carbon footprint for you and then doesn't allow you to spend money past your carbon footprint. So it can start to calculate. So, I mean, that's a, that, you know, those are on a personal level, you know, people say, oh, well, if we change, you know, our habits, that still, you know, doesn't have an impact. But, you know, a huge percentage of carbon emissions come from our food and agricultural impacts. And so there's a piece there, there's a piece about our own. And then really, I think it's around kind of these large institutional changes. As you said, if we can make dirty power go away, then, you know, if there's no longer a market for coal power, then if it is, you know, for renewables, and I think South Africa was the first country in the world where we went below parity. So it was cheaper to actually create a megawatt of renewable, particularly for us solar, than it was to do nuclear or to do coal. And so I think that as the financials come into play, I think that that's going to be important. But quick aside, I was on the plane watching, I watched the two new movies on Ruth Bader Ginsburg, RBG. She's a Supreme Court justice in the States. And it's interesting because she very much from a legal perspective was a women's liberation proponent, but she did it in a time when she watched a younger generation taking to the streets and really agitating for what they saw to be social change. And she, you know, has said that she, that's not the way she wanted to do it. And so for me, I like sitting in the position where I feel like I'm working very much in a very traditional kind of financial way to push some of this movement. But I love watching this younger generation just absolutely take to the streets and demand it. And so I think that it's, that's not potentially how I'm going to do it. I mean, I'd love to be part of, you know, these protests, but I love that there is this impatience in the younger generation. And I think it can help us say, yeah, actually, you know, it's maybe not enough. And so I think that that interesting combination of a generation, more my generation, that's kind of that edge of like Gen X baby boom, that is kind of impassioned, but kind of part of the system. And then this younger generation that just absolutely wants to tear it down. I think that's a really nice combination. Nice. And I think it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Nice. As we're starting to come to an end, and because of everything you just said, you know, I just wanted to quickly ask you, so how did you evolve into becoming the only pattern power or superpower, as I would call you, that is here with us today? Any insights that you can share with us? And
well, I found a husband with a really cool last name. That's part of it. So. No, so I think, you know, for me, so I started off in investment banking before the financial crisis, and I really love finance. I'm an analytical person, loved it. But I felt very uncomfortable very, very early in my career with the work that I was doing and what I was perpetuating from a societal perspective, particularly some stuff about for-profit education, things around, you know, healthcare in the States, things that really made me very uncomfortable. And so I think that it was really a beautiful moment when I realized that I could take those skills and use them to actually change the world. So one of the things I often say is that I do is I hack finance. So, and that's what my online course on Coursera is called, Hacking Finance to Change the World. And I think that it has changed so much in the past 8 years. I started in India working at Unitas Capital, and there was a set of us that are all still in the impact space. And we would meet at a Bangalore bar and discuss things that we thought could happen. And I found some writings from that the other day. And I think we didn't have any idea how technical it was going to become, but we also had we were a lot more optimistic for how fast capital was going to flow. And I think that fortunately, we've gotten to a place where there's a lot of sophistication, but we still haven't seen yet the real capital flow. So I think that I'm very much encouraged by all the people that are around me and by my students, executive students and graduate students that are pushing for bigger, better things. And so one of the things for me is I want to continue to stay at the forefront. I want to be, you know, thinking about really interesting structures, thinking about using, you know, these kinds of technology to do stuff that is next. And I often joke that sometimes it feels like I'm beating my head against a wall. But if you keep doing it long enough, you know, you'll either break through the wall or get a concussion. And so I'm not sure which it is, but it took a lot of years to create a, you know, an impact bond in South Africa, which we did. It took a lot of years to build up this idea of creating, you know, different types of structures. And so I think that the momentum for me is giving me a lot of energy right now. There's too much stuff to do. Frankly, it's paralyzed by choice. There's so much happening. And I think that I'm really grateful that some of my time gets to be teaching the next generation of individuals. And then another piece of my time is actually teaching executives that are already very deep into their careers. And for them, this light bulb moment that they can run companies that can be inclusive and innovative and impactful and profitable. It's just, it's such a fun thing to get to turn that light bulb on for them. So I think I just get a lot of energy from that. And I hope that I'm impacting in some way.
And where do you get your energy from, or who inspires you
That's a great question. Lots and lots of people. I actually have some really wonderful women that have been incredible mentors to me, and I've had male mentors as well, but a few women that have been really amazing mentors to me over the years. And
I'm sure that you have a long list.
I do have a long list, but I'd say there's one of the women that helped start United's Capital, Kylie Charlton. Mm-hmm. Who's in Australia. Another is a very good friend of mine here in London, Tracy Austin, who's running the Omidyar Spinat Luminate. And then other friends, like my very good friend, Ross Baird. He and I were in India together when he was starting Village Capital, and to see what he's gone on, and now he's left to do a new project, and see what he's gone on to do has been pretty impressive. And then, you know, my mentor at Oxford, Pamela Hartigan, who she ran the Skoll Center for Social Entrepreneurship for years. And she was someone that gave me some of the advice that I really, really helps guide me. And she passed away 2 years ago, unfortunately. But there's a lot of times when I'm doing stuff that I think, like, I'm pretty sure Pamela would love this. I'm pretty sure that she would be incredibly proud of this. So I think, yeah, that's a few. There's lots. Nice. Lots.
Nice. So there's Carly, Austin, Ross, and Pamela. Yeah. Thank you to you. And since you mentioned that, there's a few things that Pamela shared with you, and we asked as well as the first question, we tend to ask this last question, which is about what makes a good leader. What did you pick up from perhaps Pamela, or that you can share with others that you think is a characteristic?
So there's two things that she told me that always stick in my mind. One of them is, don't get caught up in small things. So she had said, you know, Ani, there's going to be a lot of smaller things that can take your attention and your time, and if you let them, but keep pushing towards the big things. And she's right. You can have small, shiny objects that can distract you. And then the other was...
Or dark objects.
Yeah. Or dark objects, yeah, either way. The other one was around life balance. So she used to say, you know, you have these balls. You have work, your spouse, so your spouse, your children, and your health. So she said, it's okay. Sometimes your relationship with your spouse and your health are going to be great, and your work, and you're not going to have enough time with your, you know, your kids. And this was, at the time, I thought this was a little bit like, whoa. But she said, you know, and obviously some people have a thing where some are glass and if you break them, they drop. But she said, you know, just realize they're not all going to be in the air at the same time. And that's okay. And so I think it's, you know, there's a strive to do everything and be everything. Yeah, and
it has to be perfect.
Yeah. Exactly. And so I think her just saying, like, listen, over my career, like, she had an amazing storied career, you know, and she said, there were times when this worked and this didn't, and that worked and that didn't. And, but know that it's a phase, and that you keep pushing forward, and you keep valuing things that are important to you, but realizing that, you know, not putting that guilt on yourself. And so those are two things.
Excellent. And if people want to get in touch with you, what is the best way?
So you can find my website if you Google Intelligent Impact. I will pop up. Otherwise, LinkedIn and Twitter. On Twitter, I am at Ani,
yeah,
which is pretty awesome. so, but yeah, and you can actually on the website, you can schedule quick 15-minute calls with me.
Okay. And then I was just going to add, so if you want to connect with Ani and you do it via LinkedIn, make sure you mention Impact Leaders Podcast, because this is how you found out about her. If you don't know each other, and then, you know, also why you should connect with her. It's always good to give a reason.
Yes.
And then lastly, if you could just share one last call to action for the listeners.
Yeah, sure. I think my current piece is, it's not enough to just create a whole pool of impact capital. I really think that it's very important that we go back to, you know, what actually works. And so potentially, I mean, I'm not going to say burning down, but maybe I will, potentially burning down the traditional VC private equity structure that requires exponential returns to potentially individuals that are sitting outside of communities that they're investing in. So maybe that's going to be the model that works. Maybe we're going to adapt it, but maybe we're going to come up with a brand new model that creates value and wealth for individuals that are actually the ones, the end users for these companies, as well as making money for investors. And I think that I hope that impact investing continues to push the boundaries of, you know, how we distribute capital, how we distribute wealth, and how we treat the environment. And that's probably going to require that we blow some stuff up in the sense of very traditional thinking around investing. And it's going to be uncomfortable, but I think it's going to be fun.
Okay, so let's go and blow some things up, guys.
Sounds good.
So thank you so much for your time, Ani.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
It's a real pleasure. I'm sure we can go on for a long time.
I think we probably could.
But that's it for today. Potentially we do another one soon once we
Sounds
have
good.
More. So thank you so much for listening. So it's bye for now and until our next episode of Impact Leaders. And please remember to check our sponsors' website for upcoming events as usual. Thank you.
was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.